And we'll start putting values on these things that we've taken for granted, and hopefully that will help our ability to sustain them for future generations.
We'll get into that water cleaning function because Mark has a lot of experience in that, I think, in one of the later sections. Anyone else care to comment on any of these?
I'd like to make a comment on...
Could we hold that till the end? We really want to keep it to the panel.
You wanted the status quo, and you're saying there's no statistics and no information out there, but I went to a presentation...
Keep it short, please.
...on the Suwannee River. It's 40% of its original flow. It was from cutting down trees and withdrawing groundwater that has made the water in that river drop, and I think that we can apply that to the San Jose.
Appreciate the comment, but really, if we start calling on everybody, we'll never get through this. So, anyone, Mark?
Well, I mean, I'd like to just jump on the why do we have to irrigate at all? I think that that's a really good question because I think this gets to the fundamental changes that we need to consider with regards to our expectations of what is our landscaping around our homes and community look like. I think a lot of our development style begs the need almost to irrigate to maintain. You know, Pierce has the term life support, and many of our landscapes are on life support because of the fact that we don't have anything that resembles a natural soil profile by the time you're done with the development process. So a lot of expectation of using Florida-friendly plants or natives don't even like the soils that we leave behind because from a pedological standpoint, there's no fertility left in the sense of a soil profile that had developed under its natural conditions. Now, when it comes to agriculture, that may be a different answer. The question becomes, can you have a viable or a productive enough agricultural system to make it economical? Much of the agriculture right now, or for a long time, was without irrigation. And those practices had to be restricted to that. Now, basically, as intensification may be needed for economic purposes, you're going to have to start irrigating, which then has a demand. So I don't...
That's the biggest frustration I have is irrigation in the urban setting. And you look at things that we could give up without any economic impact, bam, it's right there. There is, because there's so many options. And you can go, well, since you drive by my home, you probably don't notice it. My lawn is as green as any. I haven't fertilized or irrigated in 20 years. And it's as green as any other grass. Not as dark a green. And that's the thing when we used to do the extension programs. We'd go out and I'd talk to homeowners and I'd say, what do you consider a beautiful color of your grass? And they'd say, a good dark green. I'd say, I see a dark green grass and I see a negative. I know what it took to make that color. Because I knew that there's nitrate going out from underneath it. If there's a little yellow tinge to it, that's a beautiful grass. But you can still have full cover. We got to change socially what we accept as a viable landscape, because native landscape without irrigation can be beautiful. And it's just not needed.
Pierce, you have a comment? I'd like to echo what Del just said and say that I agree completely. Why do we irrigate at all in landscape, urban landscapes? I agree completely. We should stop that completely. That's just the direction we need to go in. The question below it about what do I advocate if I don't advocate water sense? It's not that I don't advocate low flow toilets, all the good things we can do. What I don't advocate is that you then give somebody the reward of the water sense label, the Energy Star label, without verification, because my experience in looking at the data is that those labels do not correspond to reduced consumption. And so I say, yes, do this, and you get to keep the label as long as your consumption levels are low. But don't say you're energy efficient or water efficient when in fact that's not what your data shows. And that's the problem with these labels. If you put in, it's what's called the deemed value, put in a low flow toilet, the deemed value is 1.6 gallons, 1.28 gallons per flush. Now, over time, it starts a flap, gets a little loose, you got a little leakage, and maybe it's not accurate anymore. But you don't know that if you don't just monitor what you've got. Smart metering is allowing us to do a lot more of that. but I just don't want to see certification programs substitute for actual measurement of what we're doing. So that's the answer to the question. I do applaud the Water Sense program for the ideas they promote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got one final comment on the irrigation issue about, you know, should we eliminate irrigating? That there's, you know, it doesn't necessarily, and I personally don't think we should be irrigating as well, but I think there's also an opportunity to have a broader discussion about certainly irrigating when you have daily afternoon rainstorms is absurd. And how many times have we seen, you know, sprinklers going on or agricultural operations that basically want to ignore the weather? And so, you know, I'm not even suggesting we do a compromise, but certainly some of the current irrigation practices aren't even taking into account the natural weather system. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, I would draw the line pretty hard in the sand that we need to be paying attention to the weather when we're irrigating, and we need to be thinking about the kinds of plants that we're supporting and if they make sense to be there.
It's easy to draw the line, it's hard to enforce it.
Yeah.
There's the enforcement police over there, and it's a tough job enforcing the requirements that are there today. Yes, ma'am?
Just one last comment that was up there, and it was about the clean water fee or stormwater fee. I mean, none of this comes without a cost. I mean, right now we have the cost of impacting the water quality or quantity, but any best management practice, any infrastructure needs to be maintained and optimized. We like the idea of what we call structural practices because we can put them in and have a higher level of assurance that they're going to work, but you have to maintain them to maintain their optimization, and you've got to pay for that somewhere. And so everything, you know, that we're talking about, source control is always the best approach, but there's going to be stuff that comes off, and that stuff that comes off, you have to have infrastructure in place to try to intercept it before it gets to the water body of concern. And if you don't have the resources to do that, you essentially are not going to optimize your ability to protect the resource.
Let me add one thing to Dr. Kramer's comment and this great question about water fees. I've been wondering if we had an initiative on the ballot, like Amendment 1, but required charging for water for all significant users, what would be the vote on that? Amendment 1 was 75%. I don't know that the environmental groups or whoever would have the wherewithal or the guts to do that, but to put something on the ballot and put it up to Floridians, if you're sucking 5 million gallons a day out of the ground, should you pay for that? Most states, or many states, one does. California, which I think has the most profitable agricultural economy in the country, most people are paying for water out there to grow their crops. They seem to be able to make a living. But, you know, it's anathema here. There's a long history of this. And there was an article in the Gainesville Sun. It appeared first in the Jacksonville newspaper a month or two ago by Preston Haskell, who's a very prominent businessman, has a large company in Jacksonville that does architectural work and other work. And he came out very strongly arguing for water fees. You know, this was not an environmental organization. This was a well-established industrialist advocating this. And there's some of us who are going to try to sit down with them and see where this discussion might lead. But I was astounded to look in some of the history in Florida that, you know, there had been governor's commissions as recently as 20 years ago under Governor Martinez that recommended water fees that went nowhere, and they even graduated them. I think they had, you know, 10 cents a thousand gallons for everybody, but 2 cents for ag, and ag still went nuts. So the discussion's been out there, and more recently than 20 years ago, but politically it's a hot potato, and I think the only way that could ever happen in this state is through a citizens' initiative. I just suggest people think about whether that would, what the vote would be on that. I mean, unlike Amendment 1, I think there'd be a lot of lobbying and a lot of money spent on that one.
And I think a good example is in Cynthia's book, Raj, talking about fees, where, I forget where it was, but there was a local council or commission voted to put in fees, and they all got kicked out of office the next time.
It's been known to happen. Tom Swihart has a book called Florida's Water. He has a great little chapter in there, about 10 pages long, on water fees. If everyone's interested in water fees, I might look at Tom Swihart's book. Well, okay, keep them coming, Mary, and I'm going to press on to topic 2. So we've done
where are we? Now we're going to do first down. Where are we going? And I'm going to turn to Dr. Kramer, because I'm pretty sure this is yours. It's a very good question. How should county policies incorporate the known implications or uncertainties of climate change into the management of water resources? And then I added to it, from your knowledge, what can we expect in the future, especially regarding rainfall patterns? I know the science is not definitive on rainfall patterns. We've heard, you know, the popular press is all over the place on what we can expect, and the level of certainty is probably not real high, but how should the county be thinking about that? What do you personally feel, think, as a scientist about what we're going to see in terms of rainfall patterns?
Yeah, well, and I think there's a couple other questions that you may have folded into that, raising this broader question of what, for a dialogue and for thinking about the future, what kind of a framework can we put into a place to start to think about these, you know, somewhat complicated, somewhat uncertain changes in the future, especially when it comes to the environment. And I would just, you know, sort of throw out some activities that are happening at the county level, the state level, and the federal level in many parts of the United States that may provide, be of benefit. And that is the idea of some kind of framework for assessing those vulnerabilities. What are the key vulnerabilities? And I know there was some discussion of understanding, even with existing land use activity, what the vulnerabilities to the water supply are. And we can apply that same framework in dealing with this sort of 100-pound gorilla or 1,000-pound gorilla of climate change. Where are the vulnerabilities in Alachua County, and can we identify those, economic, social, and environmental, and develop a framework to addressing the change in the future with maybe some kind of response strategy? And that's kind of one of the things I think, you know, the panel and the future activities with the EPAC committee could think about addressing is developing a comprehensive climate change adaptation strategy to start to deal with some of these issues. They're complicated. There are complexities with, you know, the Earth's climate system, soil system, certainly how humans interact with them. So it's, you know, it's not something we will necessarily accomplish tonight, but having that framework and developing it, there are many other examples of other counties who have climate change action plans that maybe, you know, we could take a look at as an example and start to have an open discussion about what a climate change adaptation strategy might look like. With respect to rainfall, I often talk about rainfall as a climate change scientist in terms of uncertainty, and we have a lot of uncertainty when it comes to climate change, and rainfall is one of them. It's one of the more uncertain components of future climate system, and that doesn't necessarily mean that rainfall patterns aren't going to change. It's that our capacity and our ability to predict those changes right now, the science is not quite there. So, you know, we do know the temperature is going up, and as a consequence of temperature increasing in the future, we're going to get a change in the water budget, and that we are certain of. And that change in the water budget will be heading towards a greater evapotranspiration. So, you know, we can speak to the certainty of change in the water budget. As far as actual rainfall patterns and predicting the frequency and intensity of rainstorms, it's being addressed by many scientists throughout the country and in the state of Florida and here in Alachua County, and I think our ability to understand that will improve in the next decade.
You know, you're setting yourself up for the fall here, because they're going to push you to get on EPAC, and then the commission's going to assign you this job you just said they need to do. It's been known to happen. So I'm warning you. Can I ask you a science geek question?
Sure.
That I think has some relevance, which is, and there are people in this room that know this a lot better than I do, like Dr. Still sitting there, but in the context of some of the minimum flows and levels for local streams and so forth, when I read some of the district's justifications for why we shouldn't worry about lower water levels, they often refer to the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation.
Yes.
And we're in this low period of rainfall because of the Atlantic, am I saying it right?
Yeah.
The AMO.
Yeah, the AMO.
And I went on Wikipedia one day, and it said
AMO is going to affect South Florida just the way the Water Management District said it would. However, it said North Florida operates 180 degrees from that. So we have the Water Management District sort of pulling in a cool term that nobody understands and saying, well, of course, that's the rainfall pattern. We're in a low period. Wikipedia at least said they're misapplying it. Do you have any, I hate to be geeky here, but in terms of, you know, decadal kind of stuff, we know rainfall patterns have changed here. What does the AMO tell us about what's going to happen?
So, you know, our climate system in North Florida is complicated. We have two sort of drivers of weather. One of them is continental, and our weather actually originates from the Pacific Ocean as we get these frontal systems coming in the wintertime. So El Nino, La Nina cycles play a big role in our weather patterns, which are dictated by sea surface temperature anomalies and the actual storms you get coming off of the Pacific. And as well, during the summer, we switch to a more convective system and we get air mass influences coming in from the Bahamas. And so, you know, both of those may interact in a complementary fashion or a negative one as far as creating future trends of rainfall, which is one of the reasons we have a lot of uncertainty. But to say that our weather system is dominated by that, the Atlantic Oscillation Index is probably, you know, not quite, probably a stretch, and I think I agree with that interpretation that the southern part of the state is not as influenced by these frontal systems as we know and by the El Nino, La Nina patterns. And so, you know, getting into this climate variability of, you know, how do El Ninos and La Ninas, we also have the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is now entering a warm phase on the West Coast, which in turn is going to affect the nature of the El Nino events that we get here. One of the reasons that we don't have the certainty that we do with temperature is what you just said.
This will all be on a final exam, right? So you're saying Wikipedia makes more sense than the Water Management District. Thank you. That's what I thought. Dr. Jones, you kind of addressed a bunch of this, but I don't think we quite got this specific question answered, which probably was from you as well. How are water usage patterns trending in newer developments? Is water use in newer developments better or worse than existing developments? And is it true that 90% of planned homes in this county will have in-ground irrigation systems when they move in?
I didn't write that question, but that is the trend is toward greater water consumption. I would say 90% will have in-ground irrigation systems. If it's west of 13th Street, they will have irrigation systems. Not necessarily east. Does everybody know where Oakmont is?
Can you speak a little loud?
Does everybody know where Oakmont is? Where Parker Road is? Parker Road is the boundary of the urban cluster, and Oakmont is 23rd and Parker Road. It's a 1,000 home community. It's probably the biggest community, master plan community that Alachua County has seen. I'm not really sure about that, but it's one of the biggest for sure. Oakmont is at the very beginning, the front edge of what it's going to do. They have not revealed their landscape requirements yet, but all of the model homes that are currently being built that were in the parade of homes and are going to be available all have in-ground irrigation. So I assume the next 1,000 homes built on Parker Road west of Hale Plantation, west of Wiles Plantation, across the street from Cambridge Forest, all irrigated landscapes. And that's it, right? That was the answer.
Yeah, that's the answer. You're a psychology expert. Can you explain this, Cynthia?
No, but I would only point out that it means we're going in the opposite direction of the national trend toward Americans using less and less water all the time. It means that we in Alachua County are bucking the trend in the wrong direction. And that is really surprising, and it doesn't have to be that way.
I'm going to ask one more in the second category, where are we going, and it's going to be for Dell. And it's a good question because it's timely. There's an issue in this county that was on the I think the front page a couple of days ago involving agricultural best management practices of a property in the east part of the county. Many of you know, probably most of you know, that when the state formulates action plans to clean up water basins, a key part is often best management practices from agriculture that are done by sector, poultry or silviculture, what have you. And I think this is your question, and it's a good one, Doug, which is, can agriculture BMPs alone meet our water resource restoration targets? And obviously that's mostly water quality, but I also, as mentioned earlier, ag is about half of water quantity in this county, so it's not irrelevant to water quantity either. So how would you answer your own question? I assume you've thought about your own question.
Well, it's a question that comes up constantly. And the answer, the quick answer is that BMPs alone, best management practices, are not going to meet the targets to which we've set for our water resources. It's going to have to be more done. We're looking at what we would call advanced BMPs is potentially coming in to take us to that next level. But the thing that's driving BMPs within agriculture is the economics of what can they afford to do and stay as a viable industry, maintaining it. And that's where the cheese gets binding, is the fact that you can go so far, and currently we are subsidizing, because the first level BMPs are not sustainable in a lot of cases economically by the farmers. So we have cost share programs coming through, Natural Resource Conservation Service, Florida Department of Agriculture. They're doing and trying to help. And for them to remain with the BMPs, we can mitigate. And we're looking at reductions. For example, the BMPs that we implemented within the Everglades agricultural area has been documented. We've gotten about 58 to 60% reductions of phosphorus going into the Everglades by those BMPs. Very significant. The target, long term, is 90%. Can they go any further from an agricultural standpoint? No. You've got to go to some sort of treatment system. And currently, if we're looking at on our deep sands here in North Florida, where we're discharging to springs, what are the options? If you're growing a crop and fertilizing, you're going to lose a fraction of that phosphorus and nitrogen, primarily nitrogen, to groundwater. You cannot have a viable agricultural operation without that occurring. We can minimize it, and the practices that I've spent my career trying to develop have been successful. We've gotten up to 50% reductions, which is significant. But when you need 90% reductions, it's not going to get you there.
Boy, we could spend an hour on that. There's scientific questions, there's economic questions, there's ethical questions. I mean, part of the problem, I'm not going to get on too big a soapbox, but part of the problem is a lot of the ag here, you know, is growing crops that aren't really well suited to the land. And so they need to put on more pesticides, herbicides. I heard a number, I don't know if it's accurate, but it was in a book called Tomato Land. It said the amount of herbicides, pesticides, fungicides to grow a tomato in Florida is six times what it is to grow a tomato in California. So we're growing crops in places that require huge chemical inputs, which makes profitability, as you said, more difficult. But, you know, that's an ethical question. Should they be growing it there? That we don't have time to get into that, I don't think. Miriam, at the end of the second section, would you like to take a break and ask some questions here? By the way, is there still pizza?
There's still pizza back there.
There's still pizza? Okay.
Yeah. We can take a real short break and reconvene. Do you want to do that?
Or should we plow through it?
The panelists might like to have a drink of water.
Let's leave it up to the panel.
I'm not sure.
Let's plow through. Yeah, okay. Let's plow through. But are there any questions you'd like to stop quickly before we answer?
I'm in the middle of typing one in.
On the second to the last question, I don't think Pierce was saying that low-flow toilets don't cause a decrease in consumption. Low-flow toilets are effective. They're really effective if you do the switch, if it's a switch out. And you weren't saying that, right?
Mary, do you want to have some time at the end of this to allow the audience to ask questions?
Well, that's what they're doing.
That's what they're doing. Okay.
So let's see if we... the questions that have been asked since the last time I read this are, we need to get away from grass lawns entirely, don't we? I think that's a given. Water Conservation Initiative Report PDF online has groundwater use data in Table 1.2, the useful information. Great Falls not changed statistically in the last 50 years. Withdrawal of groundwater is absolutely the cause of dropping water levels statewide. The low-flow toilet question you just addressed, and then what varied approaches should be considered to change in in-ground irrigation in new developments? I might not type that in right, but I think everybody gets the gist of that. And what groups can be pulled together for education of the public in the city? That might be a question to address.
I would take a stab at that and follow up on your comment about the tomatoes, because it's actually somewhat related. Is that, you know, can we ask ourselves the question, and can, as a county, can we answer the question of what crops can be grown here with a low environmental footprint? Is it possible? Are there crops that could be economically viable that would have the low nitrogen requirements, that would have the lower irrigation requirements? And have we really asked that question? And I think that's, again, something that I don't think we've exhausted the science on that by any means, I'll put it that way. And following that, I think in that same line in terms of development, what are, the range of alternatives for approaches and alternatives in ground irrigation that could be explored in conjunction with these developments? And have we identified the range and what the environmental footprint or impact could be with those ranges?
Any other panelists care to weigh in on any or all of those?
My question would be is, if we come up with an alternative crop, is everybody willing to eat it? Well, we essentially address the need to, holistically. We all are moving more towards a local food consumption, and that addresses other aspects of sustainability. So are we willing, if we identified an alternative crop that was more sustainable in our local neck of the woods, would we all be willing to change our behavior to consume it? So,
was it Michael? Was it Michael Dukakis, who was campaigning in Iowa and was suggesting the Iowa farmers ought to grow arugula? Do you remember that? It's not helpful to his campaign. You remember that question? All right, let's move on. We've done. Where are we? Where are we going? Now we're going to do. What do we do about it? This is really the most important section of the three. What do we do about it? I'm going to come back to Dr. Jones, and you've addressed quite a bit of this already, but you did focus on development, and there's a question here that reads, isn't existing development or the built infrastructure our biggest problem? Can water conservation strategies work for existing developments? Again, irrigation and fertilization are the really needed, are the realistic, socially acceptable alternatives. I know we've addressed quite a bit of this, but I think we have to face the reality that most of this in the residential setting, water use and fertilizer use is not a new development. You clearly need to do that. It's an existing development. And again, there's a county ordinance working through the process that covers a little bit of this, but what can we do creatively on existing built infrastructure?
The reason I keep snapping back to the developments that are now in the approval process is because once the homeowner association is established and the rules are in place and everybody who bought into that community has signed on the dotted line, yeah, that they agree to those practices, yeah, that HOA has regulatory authority. And even in the midst of severe droughts, they still insist on landscapes being maintained. And I watched this in the Tampa Bay area during the 2008-2009 droughts. I saw people go to jail because, not because they were making a stand, it's because they were out of work, couldn't afford the water bill, didn't water the lawn, HOA said you had to replace the turf, didn't have the money to replace the turf, ignored the HOA, ignored the judge when the HOA took them to court, and then went to jail for contempt of court. That happened. It was in the St. Pete Times October 2008. At the same time, the Swift Mud was saying, no more watering in of turf grass landscapes because we're out of water. In March of 2009, the Tampa Bay water reservoir went dry. No more withdrawals from the Hillsborough and Alethea rivers were possible. And that's when the desal plant had to kick in and make up for what they had in the way of groundwater. So you watch that at the same time that the water management people are having those kinds of problems, the HOAs will not respond. They don't have a social, one of the concerns I have with this discussion is we think we're talking like these groups have a conscience or an ethic. I know it sounds funny, but I didn't mean to be funny. They're not, and the developers are not. And when I'm talking about Oakmont and the way that they're being organized, there's nothing insidious about it. The company, ICI, that is the developer, has built communities all along the east coast of Florida, and they're building a product that customers are happy with. They're buying their homes, and they're watering their lawns. And they will water their lawns, because if they don't, the HOA will fine them. So the question, what are you going to do about existing development? In California today, HOAs, it is bad enough that HOAs are recanting. But it takes a supermajority of people in a community who are members of the HOA in order to change the rules of the community to allow people to not have water-demanding lawns. And so how do you encourage that? I don't know, I don't know that you're prevented from having a tiered conservation rate structure that makes it at least financially onerous to use water that way. That's one thing you could do. There are other things you can do with the new ones. I don't know what you can do, though, with existing. But I'm going to give you an example. Turnberry Lake. Everybody know where that is? Jonesville. Go north from Jonesville. You know where the soccer fields are, the tennis courts? Okay, Turnberry Lake is immediately to the south of the soccer fields. Turnberry Lake, for the last 5 years, has averaged 525 gallons per day per household. There's some households in that community using over 1,500 gallons a day. One household. Now, I don't know what you're going to do to convince them that something needs to change. I really don't know. They were very big in the soil moisture sensor program. They worked with GRU. They encouraged their homeowners to put in wells to save money. Do we want that? I'm not sure what you can do with an existing situation. I don't think you can legally interfere, to be honest. I don't think the county has any role in an existing community. But you can send the message by starting with the new communities and the ones who are in process right now. Okay?
It's a good answer.
The staff, and Gus is a member of the Development Review Committee, periodically he's on that committee. If you look at the staff reports of any community, this is the one for Oakmont. This is the final approval. And you look at the report that a commissioner is going to see in the meetings where they're doing their voting and asking their questions. And generally not very many people show up for those meetings on a regular old development if it's not Plum Creek. And you read the report, and here's the section on landscaping. See that long section right there? Got the little orange line by it. The word water is not mentioned. But the word water is mentioned on the next page. It says water and wastewater services. This development is located in the urban cluster and will connect to central water and sanitary sewer provided by GRU. That's it. Approved. Now, I'm not saying staff should do anything different. They're not being asked to do anything different. There's nothing to comply with. There's no requirement to meet a water efficiency standard.
So that could be incorporated into the development?
That's what I'd like to see, because once the basic premise of the community is agreed to and the developer goes forward, Arbor's Green is the number two, 495 gallons per household per day. They just went through phase two, July of last year. They were approved. Same language that I just read you was in their approval. The data was right in front of you, and they were looking at approving phase two. So you already know exactly what's going to happen. 122 more homes behaving like the previous ones just built with the data to demonstrate it, and yet not a word. And the commissioners are unaware. They can't even use the bully pulpit to say, well, gosh, your water consumption, you're number two in the county, the second highest water using subdivision in the county. Can't you cut back a little bit? Can't you do something?
Pierce, there's nothing legally to prevent a commission from doing that as part of the approval process?
There's certainly nothing legal to prevent them from getting on the bully pulpit and getting a quote in the newspaper. I mean,
well,
that's the very least.
Clearly, but how about actually requiring certain strategies as part of the development approval process?
I would have to
defer to the legal one.
What GRU would have to say, I would have to defer to others on that, but I mean, I definitely think.
Let me turn to Cynthia, who's an expert on education and has seen a lot more than we have around the country and the world